Welcome to Talking. This is D.G. Martin, and my guest is UNC Chapel Hill creative writing professor Marianne Ginger. You're the former chair of the department. Are you the chair of the department?
The chair of the English department.
Director of creative writing.
Director of creative writing.
Director of creative writing. And you still, you hadn't been able to get out of doing that.
Well, fortunately, there are many competent people in our creative writing program, and so we've just had a succession of wonderful directors, and I'm not doing it right now.
Okay, so you're not doing it right now.
No, I'm not doing it right now.
But you all passed that around. And
We pass it, it's a hot potato.
You got great, gosh, you got, in addition to yourself, Marianne, you've got great, if we start listening, we'll forget somebody. But, I mean, you've just got a great cadre, I think, of people who are not only good writers, but they're also student-centered people who really don't take the idea of working with young writers as a burden, but as fun. I mean, it's work, but they just love it. They project that.
No, we do. We're a very student-centered group of people. We love working with the students. We've kept the program for undergrads. We don't have a graduate program. That's because we believe we work with undergrads as well as anybody in the country, and we don't want to mess that up by branching out.
Well, let's talk about your book first, and then back and talk teaching writing.
I'm tempted
to get into that. But you grew up in Greensboro, and then spent a lot of time in and around Chapel Hill during the time that you were writing a book that a lot of people identify with you as your first published novel, Bobby Rex's Greatest Hit.
That's right.
I mean, it's just it's just a wonderful look at the times that many of us look back on with nostalgia, but from a poignant perspective of a young woman growing up in those times. And but then you went on to become a distinguished member of the writing faculty here, and you continue to write both fiction and nonfiction. And your latest book is I don't want to call it another memoir, but it is a special. This is, you're going to correct me on this.
You're doing great so far.
This book is Adventures in Penland, and it's subtitled One Writer's Journey from Inklings to Ink. Mm-hmm. And so it's sort of the background of your memoir, but it's also a memoir of the first novel, of how the novel came to be.
Exactly. It took me, I estimate, 36 years to write that first novel because I started writing when I was 6 years old. And Adventures in Penland begins when I'm 6 years old, and I believe I'm having the stirrings of a writer. And it follows the trajectory of a writing life through thick and thin, through rejection, through hard times, good times, bad jobs, a marriage, having children, teaching, not being so successful in my early years of teaching as far as knowing what I was doing or feeling like I was getting through to the students. It's about the fumblings and the bumblings and the good times, too. And ultimately, what I wanted to do when I wrote the book was to celebrate the joy that I took in writing that first novel. Yes, some days were hard. Yes, some days it felt more of a burden than a blessing to be holed up in this little writing cubicle that I had rented over in Greensboro at the Arts Council. Had a house called the Sternberger Artists Center, and they rented out very cheaply studios to local artists and writers. And I was able to rent a studio for $15 a month, which anybody could afford, even me, and hire babysitters and get over there several days a week and dig into this project. And it was exhilarating. It really was exciting. I didn't know if I could pull it off. I didn't know if I could write a book. But that initial effort was so much fun that I wanted to go back and write a book that celebrated the writing of
writing a book about writing, and how
long it took to do it, really.
I think my comment is having the privilege of dealing with so many writers and aspiring writers that the humanization of that process, even though that wouldn't be exactly parallel another person's struggle to write, but to understand that even successful writers, successful writers, the process is all intermingled with personal life, and it's not always, you know, the easiest thing in the world.
No, it's not. You live a life while you're doing the things that you love. And sometimes the life you're living doesn't make doing the things you love any easier. Sometimes you have to jump over huge hurdles in that life that you're living to even make it to the place where you're able to do the things that you love. And so the book addresses that, I hope humorously, because, you know, as you get further and further away from the trials and errors of your life, you do look back, I think, and you know, with a bit of wryness, or you see the comedic.
Well, we're visiting with Marianne Ginger, a senior member of the writing faculty at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and her book is Adventures in Penland, One Writer's Journey from Inklings to Ink, and there is some humor mixed in. Even if you don't read the book, you can flip it and see the illustrations of another important Chapel Hill author, Daniel Wallace.
Who and is a colleague of yours
on the faculty, who not only writes, but his, you know, when he couldn't make a living writing, he could make a living drawing. And so you recruited him to illustrate.
That's right. Well, actually, I didn't recruit him. This book came about because of a series of essays that I did in a local magazine, the Rambler magazine, out of Pittsburgh. And these pieces ran one every 2 months because the magazine was published six times a year. And Elizabeth Oliver, the editor of that magazine, found Daniel and asked him to illustrate these in
That's
series.
That's so interesting. Yeah. I thought you'd recruited Daniel because you all work, probably have offices close by, but this came indirectly then.
It came indirectly. I actually knew Daniel a long time ago. He was a former student of mine because I have been teaching at the university for 100 years. And I remember him sort of vaguely as a student. He popped in and out of my life occasionally. I'd see him socially. Once I remember he called me when he was down on his luck and wanted the name of an agent or something. And this was when he was still doing cartooning for a living.
Well, for those who don't know, Daniel Wallace is the author of The Big Fish and two other very nice novels. But The Big Fish, everybody in the world knows about because it was made into a very fine movie. But yeah, Daniel Wallace, you know, until you turn him on, he seems like an ordinary person.
Exactly. But you know, his whole person, he has a kind of mischievousness that I can see why he could illustrate this book, because there's a degree of mischievousness in the book, and he picked up on that and had fun with it. And it got to a point where I had to finish my next piece so that I could see how Danny was going to illustrate it. And he said the same thing to me. He says, I can't wait to see what the next piece is going to be because I can't wait to illustrate it. So it was a fun thing to see how an artist would interpret your effort on the page, your literary effort. And so when I got ready, I saw that it was a book, and I put it together as a book. I thought, I've got to have these illustrations, and I want them in color. And so that took a little doing.
Well, this is a diversion, but let's take it. Mm-hmm. Because this is, we're visiting with Marianne Ginger about her newest book, Adventures in Penland. This is it is humorous, but it's also a very serious memoir of writing her first novel, which was very successful. But there's poignancy to it. And in a memoir like this, or in a book like this, it would almost always just be hard type on white pages all the way through. And this little book has got colorful illustrations by Daniel Wallace, a Chapel Hill illustrator and also a famous writer. And so for those of us interested in writing and publishing, this is extraordinary that you're able, in a book that's not going to be, you know, not going to sell hundreds of thousands of books.
Oh, of course it is radio show. You know, come on, everybody's going to rush out and get one.
I guess
one.
That's right. Until you're on this radio show.
Yeah.
But we're dealing with a publisher who's nickel and diming, trying to figure out how they're going to make it. Tell us about how you were able to get these, get the publisher to go to the extra expense to put these wildly wonderful, colorful illustrations to your book.
Well, I begged. I begged and begged and begged, and I really wasn't getting anywhere for a while, and they seemed fine about doing them in black and white, but then when it came time to pay for the illustrations, they weren't too keen about that. I applied for a grant, and I got enough grant money to subsidize the drawings, but not pay for them entirely. So once they saw that I was willing to go out on a limb, to contribute
something,
so they chipped
in too.
And then they said, okay, that's good enough for us. And so then they met the rest of the cost. And Daniel, bless his heart, gave me the drawings.
Well.
And actually, I own all of them now.
Oh, no.
I own the watercolors. He gave me the watercolors, too. And we worked a trade. I gave him about 8 copies of the book, and he gave me the original watercolor. So I'd say I came out the winner on that.
Well, I think for the next fundraiser for the worthy cause,
there you go.
We're going to come to you and ask you to contribute one or two of those watercolors, and we'll sell them for thousands of dollars and make somebody very wealthy. No, that's such a great story, and so wonderful that, I mean, the lesson for me is if you really think something is right, just go for it. And you went for these illustrations, and it does set your book apart. You can see Marianne Ginger's Adventures in Penland, One Writer's Journey from Inklings to Ink, in almost all of the local bookstores, and you can see one of Daniel Wallace's wonderful illustrations on the cover. And Marianne Ginger and I will be right back after this short break. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Marianne Ginger, and we're talking about her latest book, Adventures in Penland, One Writer's Journey from Inklings to Ink. And the ink you're talking about is what people affectionately call, I guess they just call, the Bobby Rex book. Or what do they, how do you talk about it when you talk about Bobby Rex?
Well, I sort of fell in love with the guy, actually, you know, so he's an old flame of mine. That's how I think of Bobby Rex.
This is such a good story. Not everybody's read it, I mean, but a lot of people have heard the story, but this is sort of it's kind of a dream that you're boyfriend becomes famous as a, you know, he's a rock star, but then it could also be a nightmare, and you kind of turn that dream into a nightmare, but it doesn't mess up totally the happy life of a wonderful woman. I mean, is that sort of the tell us that story?
Yeah, well, the whole story of Bobby Rex, and it is fiction. It's not a memoir, and it didn't happen to me. But I can remember once listening to a song on the radio. It was a song being sung by the Carpenters, if you remember that group. And it was the lyrics were something to do with the quiet chords of his guitar. I fell in love with him, but he didn't know I was there. I can't remember the lyrics exactly. And somehow that put a bug in my brain. And this happens commonly to writers. You can't get an idea out of your head. And it sort of, you know, it's like a burr under the saddle. You're going to have to deal with it sooner or later. And so I kept thinking about that phrase, and I saw the girl for some reason. I could imagine her being moonstruck by some celebrity figure that was part of her world but not part of her world. Somebody she knew who was moving on. And when it came time to sit down, my agent made me write a novel. I kept writing short stories, and she kept saying, "Where's the novel? Where's the novel?" I don't know. I don't know. You keep selling the short stories. You make it hard for me to stop for 2 or 3 years to do a novel. And when it came time to write a novel, she was the one that suggested that I go back to a story I had published earlier about this group of people who lived in Orfax, North Carolina. And one of them, a favorite son in the community, had gone on and become kind of famous a la Elvis, moved to Tennessee and become famous out of Nashville. So I remembered this song by the Carpenters and decided to write the novel from the point of view of a young girl who knew him in high school but was too afraid to speak to him. And he becomes famous and goes off, and he had met her and seen her and knew who she was because he used her name when he wrote the lyric for his hit song. He named it Pally Thompson, and that was her name. And so why did he do this? It was so bizarre because they never had any real social
and the song
connection.
Takes them into a romantic situation that might be embarrassing for her with her current situation.
Right, because the song is scandalous, and it was the type of song back in the early 60s and the late 50s. Songs were banned from radios. I remember there was a song called Little Egypt about a stripper. Little Egypt came out strutting, wearing nothing but a button and a bow, and it was banned from radio stations. And so this, it was a typical thing to do, and this song was banned as I conceived the novel because it was so scandalous and embarrassed Pally, who had moved on and was going out with a very nice and proper veterinarian. And she was innocent of all charges. But this again, you're victimized by a writer's imagination, and in this case, she was victimized by a guy who had never been her boyfriend writing a song and using her name for the title song, like Stagger Lee.
It's the beginning of a plot that just really grabs you, because we all imagine brushing with fame and having someone that we know or being able to be within the circle of a famous person so that we can drop their names. And then when it happens, all of us would say, gosh, we'd like to be named in a novel if we were a good character, or we'd like to be in the song if it reflected positively on us. But then when the author or the songwriter borrows a name because it just sounds good or it fits, and then it really comes back to hit somebody hard, we all know of situations where there have been hard feelings about things like that.
Yes.
It's just, a terribly interesting part of literature.
Yeah.
Well, all of this, now, again, we're talking about Bobby Rex, the famous first novel, and we're doing it because your latest book, Adventures in Penland, describes your journey to getting to Bobby Rex.
Yes.
Earlier you said that there was really, imagined, and I didn't pick this up in the book, but I see it now, that there's a dividing line between the time of all of your preparation to be a writer that you describe in your wonderful memoir, and then the time where you really seriously sat down to get the job done, and the thing that provided you the extra lift was this little private office that an arts group or in a foundation or somebody provided you for $15 a month. You could get away from your family. You could get this time to yourself to write, and that was that was a key.
That was a key. Now, I had tried writing at home. By this time, I had made my life extra complicated by having two little boys 17 months apart. And, you know, what I had done with all my free time before I had children was fritter it, as a lot of us do. Goof off, think that time was unlimited, but here came these two little wonderful boys, very clingy at this particular point in time. And so I would get a babysitter to come in, and I would kiss the boys goodbye, and they were having terrible anxiety separation. They always wanted their lipstick tattoos, so I would kiss their palms and then go off. They'd be screaming at the front door, sobbing with these little steamy crybaby faces, and I'd just keep on going. I'd get in my car. I'd drive around the block. I'd wait till the babysitter had pried them away from the door, and then I'd come back in the driveway, park my car, and sneak in the basement and set up my writing desk in the basement next to the boiler. And the basement was leaky. It was not a finished basement. It was disgusting with spiders and everything. And the bad thing about that writing scenario was that overhead I could hear everything that was going on. Thump, thump. Ah, he hit me, Mommy. Where's Mommy? Where's Mommy? And then the babysitter yelling at them. And it was very unsuccessful. But that's what I did initially to try to carve out some time for my writing life. Eventually, I found out about this wonderful Sternberger Artist Center on Summit Avenue that the Greensboro Arts Council managed, and I qualified for a space and was able to write my book.
Well, let's go back. I mean, that's sort of one dividing line, I guess. Mm-hmm. But the point that you make in your book is that your whole life up to that time was the critical building block of the development of a writer. And some of the stories of your early life are really sort of wonderful, including time with your family. And I want you to share whatever stories you will, but one of them is the, I call it the story of your grandfather, or the story of you and your grandfather.
Yes.
In which, I guess the point, the moral, one of the morals for me is that you don't appreciate the resource that you have in your family members until they're taken away from you.
Mm-hmm.
You want to tell that? Can we tell that story?
Yeah, we can tell that story. I mean, it comes up a lot.
He was a World War One veteran.
He was a World War One veteran. He was the first health officer. He was a doctor, and he was the first health officer for Guilford, or the second, I think, health officer for Guilford County. And that's what he did. I can remember going to visit him. He had an office in the courthouse in downtown Greensboro. And I can remember once he took me up to see the jail. I guess he wanted to give a lasting impression of what would happen to me if I did something wrong and became incarcerated. And so he thought it would be a good thing for me to go up on the top floor of the courthouse, was where the Greensboro Police Department had its jail. And I went up, and I saw the women. I didn't see the men. He did have the sense to show me the women. And they were real friendly. They waved to me. They were really nice.
Not a bad place to be.
No, he was. So anyway, he was a big towering figure in my life. But that's the only memory I have of him actually being fun. You know, if going to visit a jail is fun.
Yeah, but doing something together as college.
Because most of the time he just sat in his chair like a piece of a cinder block, you know, a bulwark. I mean, that he just had very little to do with us kids. He was worn out. He had rheumatic fever in the trenches. That's what we were told when we would see grandmother out mowing the yard with a push mower at age 70. Oh, granted, he can't do it because he had rheumatic fever that he got in World War One. So I grew up thinking of him as this sort of stern, unfun, boring person. And then after he passed away, I later found a little diary that he had kept during World War One and carried it in the breast pocket of his uniform. And I document it in Adventures in Penland. I didn't copy the whole diary, but I do give a considerable excerpt in which he just in a very objective manner, no flourishes, no literary insights, no reflections, but just lists a day-to-day, one or two sentence explanation of what he's doing. And I was amazed at the things that he had done, the things that he had seen. And he would just, you know, like casually write, treated a soldier today who blew off five of his fingers throwing a grenade, treated men 18 cases of mustard gas today, walked 15 miles, billeted for the night, soldiers got clean uniforms, we boiled the old ones, delivered a French baby today in the city of blah blah, big, fat, healthy French baby. Saw the old peasant women trundling along on the road, so sad to see them barefooted in the deep of winter, and so forth and so on. And I began to realize that he had been places and seen things and suffered things and risen to kind of heroic occasions that I had no inkling about at all. And no wonder he sat there quiet in his chair. He'd sort of done his life. And I began to see him in a totally different light. Wish I had known him when he was younger.
Yeah, we all take things from mm-hmm. other people's writings that maybe they didn't intend
yeah,
to deliver
yeah, yeah.
to us, which is, but part of that for me was that that partnership between you and your grandfather had it come at a different time. With your curiosity as a writer
right.
and his storehouse of stories,
yeah.
that the partnership would have been richer and fuller had it been able to mature.
Absolutely. I was 11 or 12 years old when he died. So, you know, I had my own fish to fry getting used to junior high school. I wasn't really.
Well, tell us about junior high school and high school, where there were certainly clues that you were going to be a fine writer, and then there were some clues that maybe you weren't going to
be. Oh, gosh. Well, junior high was, it wasn't cool to be a writer. I was considered an odd duck to be a writer.
I'm going to interrupt you.
Please.
Marianne Ginger, UNC writing teacher, member of the Department of Writing in the Department of English, and her book is Adventures in Penland, and we're talking about really her growing up as a prelude to writing her first novel, and we got her in junior high school in Greensboro. And that's the geography
where I am.
Of the whole thing.
Oh, gosh, take me out of junior high school in Greensboro. You know, I'd just like to take those 3 years out. But I had been a very successful playwright at elementary school. I had written plays since I was about in the fourth grade, and they had all been produced. I had directed and produced them. And then I got to junior high school. And do you think anybody cared about playwriting in junior high school? Oh, no. I mean, it was just a total Nerdsville enterprise. And the people who had been my willing conscripts during my elementary playwriting days avoided me, like, don't put me in another play. I'm trying to be cool. I'm in junior high school. So it was a bad time. I did have a wonderful English teacher in the ninth grade, George Helen, who was just terrific and taught me to love Shakespeare. And so that was kind of my saving grace. We did Romeo and Juliet and poetry, a lot of Shakespeare poetry in his class. And so I began to segue into thinking of myself not a playwright anymore, but a poet. Then I got to high school. And I loved writing. I took creative writing classes in high school. I took a whole semester of Shakespeare. We had a special class in Shakespeare. I read a lot of Shakespeare in high school. I had a wonderful teacher, Peggy Joyner, who was my AP English teacher my junior and senior years. And they were wonderful years as far as developing a sense of confidence about my writing. That's not to say I was the best English student. I, you know, made my share of B's in English classes, but my teachers recognized that I really loved writing, and so they were kind to me if my fellow students still thought of me as a nerd.
Well, were you a nerd? I mean, moving along, were you a nerd in high school too?
Pretty much of a nerd, yeah. I was just sort of, you know, the sort of dewy-eyed poet type, you know, and I kept sort of peering at the horizon, waiting for somebody who was sort of swashbuckling like Oscar Wilde to you know, enter the school, some sort of outside literary figure to sort of be my boyfriend, and they didn't exist.
Well, putting this in the context, in chronological context, and against the history of what was going on in the United States, we're moving from a 1950s settled age, the Eisenhower age, into the Malcolm X age.
Kennedy, yeah.
And into a time of more, I don't know, you know, into a time of more rock and roll and drugs and things like that.
Not
on the
in
outside.
My high school.
Yeah, yeah.
Not
but
yet.
How,
a few more
how,
years.
How is this going?
You know,
y'all
what
are
was,
still in an Eisenhower high school.
Well, it was, you know, in 61, I remember the biggest controversy that we had when I went to Grimsley High School was that they had changed the name from Greensboro Senior High to Grimsley, and there were bomb threats. And so for the first couple of weeks of school, as we were all trying to adapt to the name Grimsley, we were having, you know, the bells would go off and we'd all troop outside. So that was the big kind of controversy that was going on. You know, the A&T students who came over for the Woolworths, that was happening in the early 60s. And Kennedy was shot. I can remember my sophomore year, I had just gotten back an algebra quiz, and I had made a 50 on it, which was typical for me. That was a high grade for me in algebra. And I had burst into tears, and the principal came on and told us the president had been shot. So I was already crying over my algebra grade. So that's sort of what was going on during
that
time.
Well, you're moving towards a time of the time of the 60s, so the
middle and late 60s, getting ready to go to college. Yeah.
And so how about in college? Did you find support for your writing aspirations there?
I went to a small women's college, Salem College in Winston-Salem. My parents had told me that for the first 2 years of college, I had to go to a convent. No, I had to go to an all-girls, all-women's college. And I remember we looked at Mary Baldwin, we looked at Salem, we looked at Hollins. And I picked Salem because it was going to be 100 miles closer to where my current boyfriend was in college. That was the reason I chose Salem. I enjoyed my time at Salem. I had very good teachers at Salem, but I didn't have a lot of support in creative writing. They didn't have creative writing. I think they hired, you know, like one semester, they hired a man to come in, and I don't remember his name. And then another semester, they hired Robert Morgan for just a year to come in. But I had already taken poetry with this other fellow, so I couldn't get credit again. So we didn't have an undergraduate program in creative writing. But I was able to be editor of the literary magazine my senior year, and unfortunately I bankrupted it. So they couldn't have a literary magazine for 2 years after I left Salem. So I sort of had a checkered literary career.
Well, we didn't need to take a break. We're visiting with Mary Ann Ginger about her new book, Adventures in Penland, One Writer's Journey from Inklings to Ink, and she and I'll be right back after this short break. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with Mary Ann Ginger, the writing faculty at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, the author of Bobby Rex's Greatest Hit, and numerous other short stories, and also nonfiction, including another memoir. But this is a memoir. Adventures in Penland is a memoir of her writing life, the writing of her first novel. And one of the steps, Mary Ann, to writing your first novel was a contact you made with the legendary figure in Chapel Hill, Max Steele. Max, for those people, you know, for the few people who don't know, led the writing department at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, was just a piece of work. I guess that's the way. He was a great writer himself, and he was a wonderful character who inspired that many writers would tell you that he was the inspiration and the key to their writing life. And you had some contact with him, too. Would you tell us about it?
Oh, yes. I met Max, my former husband, and I were in Chapel Hill. My former husband was getting a PhD in English here in the English department. And I was sort of on the periphery of all that. I was teaching art in the public schools of Durham. And I went to a party and met Max, and he knew that I was finishing my MFA at UNC Greensboro and studying with Fred Chappell.
You're teaching art, but you were studying writing.
That's right. My day job was an art teacher in the public schools. These were the days when MFA programs had not proliferated, and there was a wonderful program. There were probably about 60 programs in the whole country at this was in the dark ages of the early 70s, and I was currently a student of Fred Chappell's at UNCG. I didn't have the luxury of quitting my job and being a full-time student, but fortunately Fred conducted his fiction workshop at night, and most of the writers in that workshop were journalists. A number of my friends worked at the News and Record in Greensboro, and some of them had other jobs in the community. Some of them were teachers, and so it was a wonderful opportunity for people who had to work. It was before the MLS programs were ever established for working adults. So Max knew I was finishing that degree, and he had read a couple of my stories. I had published a story in the Carolina Quarterly that he had read and liked. And so he said, "Would you ever be interested in teaching at Carolina?" And I said, "Good grief." I mean, I was in the trenches of public school. I was dodging spitballs every time I went to work. And I said, "Gosh, I mean, me? Who, me? Teach at Carolina?" And I didn't give it much thought until I ran into him again in the grocery store. Here in Chapel Hill, there was a big star over on Elliott Road. And he came up to me in the grocery store and he said, I have an opening in the fall. Someone's leaving. And would you like to teach a fiction workshop? And I was hired in the big star. I had to go over and meet the chair of the department and not embarrass Max or myself. But that's how it all started.
Well, teaching teaching writing and writing together is complicated in the sense that, gosh, if we had more time, I would do this more delicately. But some people who want to be writers are not that sometimes the creative spirit goes with some mental special mental characteristics. I guess I just to put it, I was got some crazy people who take writing, and for a young woman who's teaching writing for the first time, it's a challenge to deal with some of your students, isn't it?
Yes, and I have a chapter in Adventures in Penland.
It's a great story.
Creative writing class noir is what I call it, because it's about dealing with difficult students and being inept. And knowing what to do. But that's part of the process.
Well, you know, I'll tell you, this, just to be honest with you about, you've got, you're a great writer, but you've had some challenging experiences in growing up and in your lifetime, but mainly it's a pretty happy life, ordinary kind of life. And so writers need all these wild experiences to have the really great books, either via their friendships with people or the imagination or whatever it is. But so it's pretty, I mean, it's not bad to have some students who kind of challenge you and give you experiences from the other side.
And I have always been attracted to conflict. I sort of gravitate towards it like it's a necessary food or something, because I was deprived so much conflict in my early years. Flaubert, I think, says, be bourgeois in your life so you can be wild in your art. And so I try to, my whole process as a writer is to try to find the conflict wherever it lurks and sort of, you know, like wallow in it a little bit, brush up against it, and then see if I can make something of it. So I would say, yeah, it was, I'm pretty normal. I mean, I didn't, you know, grow up in a cave raised by wolves or anything like that. But I'm always attracted to conflict. And as a kid, I hung out with the weirdest people. And I'm still hanging out.
You're drawing
out with,
you're still
here I am talking to you, DJ.
Yeah, I was going to say, people will ask you what you're doing with that weird DJ Martin. And it reminds me when Pat Conroy was here, and of course he says this lots of other places in Chapel Hill, but he said that having a horrible father or having a horrible growing up experience, being mentally abused by his father, was awful. But if it had been for his father, he wouldn't be rich, because he wouldn't have had the stories.
That's right. To
the poignancy that develops from a really strained family situation. He was able to use that as the kickoff for his work,
right,
which resonated with so many people.
Right.
So, you know, you weren't blessed with the mean family.
No, this is true. This is true. It was sort of like, I don't know, it was like I say, my parents were a bunch of optimistic doofuses, and sort of I come by my optimistic doofusness pretty naturally. But I think you can, you know, I think you can be on the periphery of a lot of conflict and be a student of it and absorb enough to have something to write about.
Listen, we're out of time, but
okay.
I want you to just to give us a clue. We're going to have you back sometime, I hope, within the next few months to talk about a project that you're involved in, a short fiction project.
Yes.
Can you just tell us real quick what that's about?
Yes, this is a new book called Long Story Short, and it's a collection of 65 pieces of flash fiction, or very, very short stories.
Like 2 pages or 1 page or,
well,
3 pages?
Most of them are under 1,600 words, and the shortest one is 100 words.
Wow.
By 65 North Carolina writers. Many of these writers are quite familiar to your listeners. So it's a fun book. It's going to be out in the fall, and it's out with UNC Press, and we're going to be out and about reading from it, I'm sure.
Well, that'll be great. So that those of us who don't have time to read every North Carolina writer, or many of the North Carolina writers, can get to read 66 North Carolina writers' short fiction in the confines of one book.
Little sound bites while you wait for the bus.
Well, Marianne Ginger, thanks for your new book, Adventures in Penland.
And thanks
for sharing it with us here today. Thanks to all of y'all for listening.